So, those of you that are here, welcome. Week three, and almost the end of January. You've made both week three and the end of January. Good for you. Lecture five, January 31st, 2003. Lecture notes page, I hope, 52. So, if you have not yet done or finished your attempts for mini test two, please keep in mind, closes 11:59 tonight on the regular Tuesday schedule. If you haven't done it, I'm sure you'll hear from me yet again, reminding you to do it. Webbies, you too especially, be sure you get it done, yeah? What else? Just a reminder that this week on Friday we'll open up the first of the optional extra credits, either through enhanced learning extra credit using McGraw-Hill Connect or through PacBack. Choice is yours, or it's optional. You have to do it at all. Up to you. So business in the news. Johnson & Johnson, it's an iconic company under pressure, has decided to split into two. We were talking last week about corporate decision-making. How are you handling your individual divisions, your product lines, etc.? Here's one way of handling it. Johnson & Johnson recently announced plans to spin off its consumer products division, which is famous for household names, but not very lucrative, not very profitable brand names like Tylenol, Band-Aids, and Neutrogena. And they're going to spin that off into a separate company to be called, a brilliant marketing move, Kenvue. Kenvue, what's that say to you? I don't know what it's supposed to say, but that's their plan. Johnson & Johnson will keep its more profitable, faster-growing businesses in pharmaceuticals and medical devices. So here we are hearing something that we talked about, corporate strategies and product portfolios. You've got different strategic business units. How are you handling them? How are you managing them? The planned breakup comes after years of problems for Johnson & Johnson. The company is juggling lawsuits for its role in the opiate epidemic, and over accusations that the talc that they once used in their very popular baby powder had caused cancer in some customers. So we've got the issue of legal issues and business, that external factor, competition, regulatory, legal, and political, economic, social, and technology. Here's the legal factors in them. We're at the point on the cycle where conglomerates are less popular. For a long time, if you'd gone back in business history, you'd find it was big moves for companies to become conglomerates and bring together all kinds of different businesses, and they were going to be more efficient. Now the cycle has changed. Conglomerations are less popular. The pharma companies in particular are trying to focus more on pharma and lose things like their consumer goods products, the corporate strategies. Johnson & Johnson faces thousands of legal claims that its talc-based products may have caused cancer. The company discontinued sales of talc-based baby powder in North America in 2021, though it has said it is safe in their legal opinion. In 2022 fall, Johnson & Johnson dumped the liabilities from that business into a new division, which then last month filed for bankruptcy. That new division will remain a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson under the plan to divide the companies. The reorganization, dumping all the liabilities into a company that then went bankrupt, drew criticism from lawmakers, academics, and trial lawyers as a ploy to protect investors at the expense of customers who say they were harmed by their Johnson & Johnson baby towel product. So here you have an interesting question. Legal issue. Is it legal to do what they did? I don't know that, but I'm presuming it is. And is it ethical to do what they did? We could talk about legal versus ethical in decision making. Over time, the company has relied on the halo effect created by popular consumer products, none more so than its Johnson baby line of shampoos, lotions, moisturizers, and powder for infants. Such products have very thin profit margins, but they've created public perceptions of Johnson & Johnson as a benevolent, gentle company. So their corporate image for many people, it gives us a wonderful image that most companies would kill for, they say. But commercial value of those brands has weakened over time, even as consumers continue to refer, for example, to all plastic bandages as Band-Aids. Is that how you refer to that thing you put on your boo-boo, a Band-Aid? Of course, that is a brand name, yet we apply it to all products like that. It's sort of generic. It's a rare brand like Kleenex and Xerox, whose name is a stand-in for an entire range of products. Consumers, though, have embraced cheaper generic rivals. The same is true for products like Tylenol. So here's a bit about brand name, which we'll talk about later on, and changes in consumers' behavior. Used to buy the top name brand, now going for the cheaper generic, affecting, of course, our profit. Even lingering affection for companies' consumer products does not do much to advance J&J's medical business, the B2B side of the business, which are far more important to and profitable for the company. So again, corporate strategy at work. Ha! Who's from Pittsburgh? Heinz 57. Hoo-yah. What's the Super Bowl that's coming up? Which one? 57. Thank you. Thank you. Heinz says it's time to ditch Roman numerals for Super Bowl 57. Kraft Heinz is looking to eliminate what it says is confusion over how Super Bowl games are numbered with a new campaign titled LVII, the Roman numeral for 57, right? Means 57. It protests the use of Roman numerals, according to a press release. So a little bit of humor in their advertising. Also, a strategy, press releases, to get attention for what's going on in your campaign. The multi-channel effort is aptly timed ahead of the 2023 game, Super Bowl 57, the same number for that the brand has sported on its ketchup label for over 100 years. As part of the push, the brand launched a microsite where consumers can vote on whether or not Roman numerals should be dropped from the Super Bowl game titles. So we're getting consumers involved. And how many of us did wonder Super Bowl LVII, what is that? What number is that? Who sort of wondered that at all? Everybody knew it. Who doesn't care what it meant? All right. So the campaign also includes a minute-long ad spot that tests consumers' knowledge of Roman numerals, with the majority of respondents failing to identify what LVV means, what it stands for. The effort sees Heinz foregoing a traditional big game advertising spot on Super Bowl in favor of this humorous play. So here's an ad budget decision and getting attention with this little humorous spot and idea of doing the vote.
What does it mean?
LVII, Livy.
Roman noodles.
I thought it was military time.
Like a movie that came out, but it's like the 200 version of it. Something like that.
Because I know that is 6. 56. No, XI is 6.
I should know what this means.
That is 57?
It's like the cursive for numbers.
Get with the times, football.
Maybe use emojis or something. That's popular. More popular than Roman numerals.
You Roman numerals.
Look, I mean, if it's 57, I don't know why they don't just say 57 at this point.
Just say it's 57.
The math is not really mathing for everybody when we do it like that.
So obviously a bit of humor. They're playing with this idea, although that was all real. So LVII means 57 was inspired by hundreds of consumers who took to social media last year to protest the confusing nature of Roman numerals for Super Bowl. They proved the allegations by asking consumers that, and so that's their campaign tactic. From now until Super Bowl 57, which is slated for February 12th, Kraft Heinz is also inviting the masses to share their thoughts on whether or not the counting system should be booted via a poll at www.lviimeans57.com for the chance to win a limited edition ketchup bottle with this label on it, LVII means 57. And consumers are also encouraged to share their thoughts on social media with the hashtag LVII means 57. So we're seeing a sales promotion, the giveaway of the product, and social media and marketing. Finally, I can't get away from this next thing. It keeps coming back, which is a good PR piece. M&M's, okay? They've come back again. The M&M's aren't done with us. Was the company's recent decision to sideline its spokes candies a response to cultural backlash or just an elaborate stunt leading up to the Super Bowl? Despite the recent announcements M&M's made, the company would be taking an indefinite pause from its spokes candies in favor of the beloved actress Maya Rudolph. The truth is, they aren't actually going anywhere. Rest assured, the characters are our official long-term spokes candies. While the iconic M&M's characters are in fact spending some time pursuing other passions ahead of the Super Bowl, during the big game, its commercial will resolve the matter, returning the characters right where they belong, at the heart of the brand. So, was this whole thing a strategy to generate interest and get free publicity, because this is big out in business news? Will the brand stand up for its brand purpose of inclusivity, which is intended to appeal to younger consumers? With all this attention about his coming Super Bowl ad, consumers will just have to wait and see. How many of you guys know Cheddar News? Cheddar News? Okay, well, it's a very popular news channel for young people like y'all. Anyhow, I'm going to pretend it. Webby's? Cheddar? You know, all right, one person is Cheddar News. Anyhow, and more. So Cheddar News is running a trailer promo on their news program saying, Cheddar News, watch Cheddar News surprise guest host this Friday. So the image perhaps suggests it might be one of the spokes candies. So they're getting a lot of good buzz out of this current, quote, campaign. We'll see what happens. Stay tuned. All right, picking up with lecture notes, page 52 and page 77 in the textbook, continuing with chapter 3, where we got stuck last time. And that I put a lot of time in trying to get this to work that I wanted to, and I never did make it work. Say again, please. No, I don't think we were in the middle of talking about it, as I recall. So, what I meant to say was 51. Thank you. 51, 52. In a minute, you'll find the Vermont Country Store, hopefully, in your notes, and that's where we got stuck. So, last time we were trying to talk about this, and in the context of appealing to various age cohort groups. And so the Vermont Country Store runs a variety of things to capture the attention of post-war cohort customers, carries lots of older brands, and even brings some of them back to life. Let's see if we get it working this time the way I want it to.
A New England store is like a time machine. CBS This Morning contributor Lee Woodruff shows us how one store's loyal customers continue to indulge in the pleasures of a simpler and slower America. Its famous mail order catalog attracts customers from all around the world.
Weston, Vermont, population 600, is the unlikely home of one of the state's top tourist attractions.
135.
A third generation family owned country store that's in the business of selling nostalgia.
Bye.
Bye. What's your definition of a country store?
A country store was a place that you would go into in these small communities. 150 years ago, you didn't have the internet, and you would go to the country store to get just about anything that you needed.
In 1946, the Ortons started the Vermont Country Store catalog, and when the orders began rolling in, the Ortons opened a storefront. Almost 70 years later, the desire for hard-to-find, old-fashioned products is now a mega-million-dollar business. Customers of the Vermont Country Store keep coming back for their old favorites, and occasionally, their demand for a product has actually brought it back from extinction.
I think big sellers are usually ones that customers connect with. Products like our Tangi lipstick.
Product that went extinct.
It went extinct. It was no longer available. We started to work with a company to manufacture it.
The store and the catalog appeal to the young and the old. Another part of the country store's success? Tour buses.
I think history is a huge part of why people come to Vermont, and we have busloads of customers that come from England, and Vermont is really, feels to them like old America.
Oh, it's so cute.
The store proudly resists any urge to update its clothing to fit current trends.
And this is one of your best sellers.
One of the best. Yeah. It's enduring. It's a timeless product.
Nothing and says chaste and pure like a Lawrence nightgown, right? Like
housemade creams, lotions, and tonics fill the shelves of the store's remedy section.
There's some really cool, bizarre, old-fashioned remedies for things that you don't think about so much anymore. Bunion corrector, right?
Yes.
So in this era of Amazon and the internet where you can touch a button and get everything, what do you think it is about the Vermont Country Store that just keeps people coming back?
I feel a time-honored tradition that's there, almost a smell and a feeling that it's been here forever, and that no matter what you need, you can find it here.
A tradition that the Orton brothers aren't about to change. For CBS This Morning, Lee Woodruff, Weston, Vermont.
So you're from an older cohort group, whether you're U.S. or even coming from other countries, you want to see that stuff that brings back that nostalgic memory, those scents and sounds and smells, and scent is a smell, and imagery from your youth. Boom. They've got a market segment that they appeal to. Leading edge baby boomer cohort to continue our conversation. Born 46 to 55, age 67 to 77 in 2023. This group vividly remembers the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. It was the loss of JFK that first shaped this cohort's values, and they were catalyzed by the opposition to the Vietnam War. So this is the hippie group, right? Here on campus, May 4th, etc. Leading edge boomers are very aware of their cohort grouping. They're very self-assured. They're very self-centered. They champion causes with fervor because they were sure of being right. So if you guys know the group Greenpeace and the Civil Rights Movement and Women's Liberation, all these were championed by leading edge baby boomers when they were young. And they were equally justified in being hedonistic and self-indulgent. So pot, free love, if the van is rocking, don't come knocking. Sensuality are all part of their youth and influence them. Because of their position, following the birth dearth of the Depression years when people weren't having many children, this group had a significant influence on society, disproportionate to the numbers because they were the children of the age. If there's one thing that boomers universally hate, it's being considered old. In a society that largely ignores or coddles its seniors, they have an intense desire to remain young, relevant, and useful. If that's your target market, keep that in mind. Any reference to their age or limitations will be an instant turnoff. They still see themselves as those hippies, sort of. Appeal to them with language that alludes to the advantages of being established, not being old, the opportunities of retirement and beyond, and the authority that comes with seniority if you're trying to reach them. People say you can't what in your age? Tool to run a marathon, run an online business, get a tattoo, run for office.
People think you can't do things after a certain age or at a certain age. Prove them wrong by just doing it. I ran an ultra marathon when I was 51.
We run an online business together.
Doesn't matter your age, it matters how much energy you put into something.
I'm 28 years old and I'm running for office.
I got a tattoo at the age of 51.
Makes me feel like a rock star.
It's about how you feel and your outlook on life. It doesn't matter how old you are.
Disrupt aging, hashtag. Do what you want to do. So a company that really succeeds at digitally marketing to baby boomers is the one that just ran that ad, AARP. It's AARP's possibilities page that uses legible fonts, attractive celebrities, and positive, buoyant language about life after 60. Consider this a model for attracting and keeping an advanced audience if that's your target market. So AARP, Facebook video, is something that's relevant to baby boomers. Stress be some kind of crazy. Well, that wasn't much, but it's on their Facebook page, and their Facebook page is more for folks of this age group. Trailing edge baby boomers, born 56 to 64, age 59 to 67 in 2023. This group witnessed the fall of Vietnam, Watergate, Nixon's resignation, the President of the United States resigning, the oil embargo, raging inflation rates, and the more than 30% decline in the Standard & Poor's Index led these individuals to, well, be far less optimistic about their financial future than were the leading edge boomers, whom they feel got bigger opportunities in jobs, bigger opportunities in houses, bigger opportunities in investment. Not that they're bitter or anything. This is in general across the two groups. Baby boomer grandparents are healthy, active, educated, and endowed with sizable nest eggs. Spending by grandparents on their grandchildren is on the rise. Grandkids Matters is a site dedicated to validate and empower grandparents as they bond with future generations in a meaningful way and leave a lasting positive legacy. So you're thinking about marketing to baby boomers. One thing might be, think about them as grandparents. And what do they need to know? Well, here's five great activities for grandparents and grandchildren. Here's a little video about that. Here's related posts. Where do you do your grandparenting? Other things grandparents should know, etc. And so here's a site dedicated to that idea of appealing to the baby boomer cohort in general. Gen X. Born 65 to 80, age 43 to 58 in 2023. These are the latchkey children of the 80s. They've gotten a lot of negative publicity, maybe because many of these have seen firsthand the trauma of divorce. This cohort has really delayed marriage and children, and they don't take those commitments lightly. Back in the old days, in the 1950s, anybody ever watch a TV show called Happy Days? Okay, there wasn't divorce on Happy Days. Everybody was living happily together in a family. wasn't a thing of the time, even into the 60s. These folks knew about divorce, were raised in single-family homes, knew about that trauma, and said, do I really need that in my life when I'm young? Do I want to get married and then divorce? Yes, ma'am. Well, of course, it's going to affect y'all too. But you all have your own problems coming up as well. Your own trauma to deal with. But yeah, of course, it's going to affect you as it affects them. Mm-hmm. So, to the extent that it has an emotional impact on you, you know, gives you a bit of trauma as opposed to pleasure, I guess. Yeah, of course, it's going to feed out. And by the way, your generation isn't rushing to get married either. Get married and have kids. So I think there's a carryover there. Absolutely. And the point of the conversation, of course, is this is what marketers need to keep in mind. Is they sending messages to you all? Or is there planning? Are these people going to be buying houses? Are they going to have babies that need baby equipment early on in their life? That's what we're thinking about, why we're talking about this. And the answer is for y'all, no. Gen Xers have been labeled as baby busters, latchkey kids, slackers. How many of you guys remember Back to the Future? Where in the classroom, the professor is calling to Marty and his group, slackers, you're a bunch of slackers, talking about, maybe you don't remember that, but I do, talking about this image of this group of people. The why me generation, the new lost generation, despite a rocky start into adulthood, this group does show a spirit of entrepreneurship unmatched by other cohort, which is why we have today entrepreneurship majors, entrepreneurship courses, this recognition of the entrepreneurial spirit of this group. Take another look at many internet startups and you'll find successful Gen Xers who, quote, did it their way. More than any other groups, this cohort accepts cultural diversity, and puts quality of personal life ahead of work life. This was tough for a corporate management to get its mind around. I have been in HR in corporate management for a number of years. I'm going to offer you the opportunity for promotion, and with your promotion, you're going to move to Des Moines. And people are saying, what? I don't want to move to Des Moines. I have my friends here, my family here. I'm happy here. I won't take the promotion. What? You don't want a promotion? And these people are putting more value of quality of life rather than work promotion, which is a different way of thinking about them. So how do I reach Gen Xers? Well, it's complicated. Many Gen Xers rely on traditional media still. 62% read newspapers, 48% listen to the radio, 85% have favorite television shows. For Gen X, however, email is considered the gold standard for personal communication as well as business communication. Digital video is also huge among Gen X. It's even more popular than social networking. Over 75% download or stream video online at least once a month. So your digital marketing strategy has to be on point as you reach out to these skeptical Gen Xers. As kids, they were often the children of divorce who came home to empty houses. These experiences have made them independent, resourceful, and when they get to that stage, family-oriented adults, when they finally decide to have a family. Stuff to think about if you're marketing to Gen Xers. Millennial cohort, Gen Y, born 81 to 96, age 27 to 42 in 2023. How many of you guys have older siblings in that group, 27 to 42, like? So you have to see if this describes them or not. They're also known as Gen Y. Their core value structure seems to be quite different from the previous cohort, Gen X. In 2019, this group, the millennial group, the Gen Y group, surpassed the baby boomer generation as the nation's largest living generation. Important to know if you are marketing to consumers. This group has the largest number. They're more digitally connected than any other generation before them. Obviously, technology moves forward. They're more idealistic, and they're more team-oriented without the cynical what's in it for me free agent mindset of many Xers. So when I put this together, 91% of them say, and this was probably pre-pandemic, 91% say they prefer shopping in drugstores, 68% prefer shopping in consumer electronics stores like Best Buy, 80% shopping in apparel stores, 84% shopping in department stores, 83% prefer shopping in discount and mass merchandise stores, just as insight. So as of 2020, millennial spending, Gen Y spending in the U.S. was $2.5 trillion, representing 30% of all consumer sales. Might that be a target audience for you for something appropriate, given their size? Perhaps. They trust word-of-mouth buzz more than they trust customary marketing ads. So if you are marketing these folks, keep this in mind. Make reviews a large feature of your service or product page to leverage millennials' need to conduct independent research, find testimonials from unbiased sources, and encourage your customers to submit user-generated content by having contests or discounts to get them on your page so other millennials will see their positive reviews of your product or service. Millennial generation values experiences over possessions, so we find a bunch of activity generating an experience as opposed to what we've done previously. Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines presented passengers with virtual balconies. So rather than paying for an actual balcony stateroom on your cruise, you could get a video that looks just like what they would have if you had a higher cost stateroom.
As the name implies, these interior rooms offer the unique feature of a high-definition screen that simulates an ocean-facing balcony complete with ever-changing views.
So you get the cruise and you get a real-time stream of video as though you had a balcony at a reduced rate. Have the experience. Millennials are at the forefront of the experience economy. Escape room games. How many of you have been to an escape room? A bunch. How many of you guys have done axe throwing? Not that many. So I'm not a millennial, but my wife, myself, my kid. By the way, this is often done in bars. What a perfect combination. You get to drink a bunch of beer and go throw axes. Down thing. We did up in Manhattan. It was fun. And the axe master who was teaching us how to throw axes happened to be from, this is crazy, Hudson, Ohio, which is where we are. So anyhow, we're doing axe houses, axe throwing as an experience. So here's the axe house in near Cleveland. Here is the Cleveland escape room with a bunch of new escape rooms that are out there in different, different areas, the murder mystery room, the bake heist room, the candy world and great chicken heist room, and Dracula's tomb room. So hey, this is a whole group of folks picking up on that experience that millennials want.
So
here is our guy over at Now Spectrum, Time Warner, talking a little bit about how they did not initially pick up quickly on some changes in the cohorts they were dealing with.
So what we've done, we've taken residential, moved it over to the enterprise side. You know, again, my history, AT&T, 5 years ago, we didn't even know the cable companies existed, okay? In fact, AT&T tried to get into, it was Ameritech, SBC. We're in the cable business slightly. It was decided not a core competency. We moved out, okay? Guess what? They're trying to get back in because cable companies now are taking residential telephone lines. And as the new generation, you know, they don't even go with landlines.
So they don't go with not land, but landlines. So I assume, how many of you guys don't have a landline, an old traditional landline on the phone, on the wall, whatever? Is that all? Only about half. How many of your parents don't have a landline? Still a goodly number, right? It's a new move. You would have thought AT&T might have picked up on that technology change in consumer behavior. It took them a while to figure it out, and now after the fact, as he says, they were trying to get back into that because they didn't realize a change in the cohort group. Gen Z, born 97 to 210, age 13 to 26 this year. You know anybody in that cohort group? Three of you know people in that cohort group. So they're called the new silent generation, the homelander generation. They're people who reached adulthood in the 2010s and who entered the workforce 2015 to 2025. This group of folks is generally pictured as being, compared to others, realistic. They became very familiar with computers, cell phones, iPods, video games at a much earlier age than generations late Y and all of X, leading to most of Gen Z preferring a more connected and LCD screen lifestyle. How many of you guys go to bed with your smartphone at least on your table next to you? How many of you guys go to bed with your smartphone in bed with you? Okay, you guys can't tolerate the idea of being away from... That's more you than the earlier generations. They are usually raised by leading-edge baby boomer or Gen X and sometimes have brothers and sisters of Generation Y and Z. Their parents are the soccer moms, the helicopter parents. The Gen Z calls their own shots. They refuse to be dictated to. That's tough for us in marketing because we want to tell you what we think you should be buying, of course, based on our evaluation, and you say, I don't want you to tell me what to do. Whether it be by a clothing brand, a television network, or a website, in essence, Gen Z, y'all, are creating their own experiences from fashion to entertainment to communication. Marketers have to be aware of that. Gen Z understands how scary the world can be, having grown up post 9/11 in the wake of the Great Recession and amid countless reports of school violence. Heaven help us, it continues. They've seen the effects of the economy firsthand and are more aware of troubling times. Their role models, I don't know if you all agree with this. Over the years, I've seen less and less people buy into it. But the role models are the young, everyday characters like the Hunger Games, Katniss Everdeen. How many of you guys remember her? How many of you guys liked her? She was a cool, okay, good. Who face seemingly inescapable scenarios but rise above them to create a better society, a Gen Z value. In these stories, relatable characters are empowered to defeat their circumstances, just like the Zs, who feel a responsibility to change the status quo. So if that's you, then they're describing you right. Here's Target creating a new brand for Gen Z. So we find brands paying attention to Gen Z and their need to be involved. We've designed our brand with 10 or 12 of them, said Gen Zers, to appeal to Gen Z. This is a bit much, but it goes to show you a little bit of a comparison between millennials and Gen Z, when they first appeared, what their nicknames are, who their role models are, stereotypes they're sick of hearing, for y'all that they learn to swipe a screen before they learn to speak, big events, Justin Bieber's arrest and reaching the age of maturity. Never heard of a floppy disk for the previous generation. Flip phones. You guys know flip phones. Actually, some of those are coming back, aren't they? I remember being in this room many years ago with my flip phone right here until I dropped it and broke. So there's the population, et cetera. This is not testable, but it's sort of interesting comparison between the two things. So how have you and the previous generation faced this crisis differently? So both of Gen Z and millennials have been impacted by a series of once-in-a-lifetime crises in their formative years. The dot-com meltdown, 9/11, the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the coronavirus global pandemic. But their reactions to these crises differ. Millennials were more concerned about the pandemic, with 84% of them saying they were somewhat or very concerned about COVID-19 pandemic compared to only 78% of Gen Z. Millennials say they'll be slower to return to the mall after the pandemic. 73% of millennial consumers say it may take them a while before they feel comfortable shopping again in a mall, while 62% of Gen Zers say it'll take them a while. So significantly less than their older counterparts. The point, it's important to understand differences in generational cohort responses and what these might mean for your brand. How do you deal with it, knowing how they deal with these crises? The newest generation, Gen Alpha. Again, I explained last time, literally, they went through the cycle. They came up with Z, and then they ran out of letters. They had to come back and do something. They chose to do Alpha. Yes, ma'am? It's, for me, it's, you're talking about academics making choices. Who knows when they're going to settle? Have you heard a different name for them, though?
Yeah.
What have you heard?
It was like Generation X.
Generation XZ? Okay, I believe that somebody said that somewhere. They can't even agree on the dates of the birth. We see different dates periodically, and even within the names that I gave you, it's generation something, but also millennial or homelander or whatever. So they can't agree. Right now, as far as I know, the most common accepted one is Gen Alpha, but there might also be Gen XZ too. So these guys, born 2011 through 2025, so they're newborn to age 12 in 2023. How many of you guys have younger siblings of that group, just out of curiosity? So, promises to be the most highly educated and most diverse and most technologically proficient generation ever. They may never have a landline phone or checkbooks. Electronic tablets are replacing teddy bears in their cribs at night, and they will likely text their playmates instead of passing notes in class. They're expected to be socially and ecologically conscious, thanks to their millennial parents who have those attitudes, passing on their attitudes to their children, who aren't just willing to settle for rock-bottom prices despite their frugal ways. Research shows millennials are willing to pay, the parents of these guys, are willing to pay a premium for products made by companies that they see as being authentic in espousing their values and authentic sustainability as well. So the parents feel this way, they pass it on to the kids. For now, Generation Alphas are still young, which means their parents will be making most of their buying decisions, at least for the next decade. Their moms will be calling the parent, will be the parent calling spending shots mostly. Dads sometimes get involved, but still today it's mostly moms. Today, women currently make up or influence as much as 85% of purchase decisions and buy over 50% of traditionally male products, such as cars, home improvement products, and consumer electronics. Important to know if you happen to be in those fields. So not surprisingly, millennial moms control the majority of buying decisions in the family. So if you're trying to target a millennial kid, sure, make it appealing to them. But be sure you have something for mom, who's also making those decisions for the kid. To reach Generation Alpha parents, then, be authentic. Personalize products as much as possible to their particular needs. Embrace and promote social responsibility. M&Ms. Don't ignore the kids, though they're still young. Research shows that children wield a great deal of influence in the grocery aisles. When accompanying their parents on shopping trips, they make demands that influence nearly 80% of shopping decisions. And, oh, hello, that's okay. And so I think you all know that, you know, kids do influence. When you go out to eat, are you eating McDonald's or are you eating at a fine restaurant? When you take a vacation, are you going to Disneyland or to some resort? When you go to the store, are you buying Fruit Loops or you know, Wheaties? So kids do influence the decision-making process. All right, what about marital status? We've alluded to that right now. How's that force changing over time? Well, we have people that are never married and have not been ever married later and later into their lives, yeah? You do know that at one point in time, if you were 21 years old and not married, people looked askance at you, right? There was something wrong here. Now, if you're 21 and married, you're unusual. Things change. Married, separated, divorced, widowed, what is the marital status of your particular target audience? What does it mean for your product? Cohabitation, that's the idea of living together unmarried. Again, unheard of in the 50s. Came in a bit in the 60s, but still people went, How many of you guys know, I want to ask a few personally, who know people that are living together that aren't married? Okay, at least a third, right? So, the U.S. Census has taken to measuring this idea. Unmarried partners are more diverse than they were 20 years ago. Cohabitating partners are older, they're more racially diverse, they're more educated, they're higher earners, and this goes on as a census report to talk about this group. What's that mean? Well, it's interesting from a marketing viewpoint. People cohabitating may not commit themselves to buying a house, may not commit themselves to buying that good quality furniture, may not be as interested in other sorts of things that folks who are married and committed will buy. What's that mean to you? How do you market your brand to such a group? Blended families. So, you know, the Brady Bunch, bringing together two, you guys know the Brady Bunch? Yeah, bringing together two divorced families, now they're coming together married and we have to mix and match them together. A relatively new phenomena in the world of marketing. So what are the characteristics of your Target market. What does it mean for their needs, wants, and desires against your brand? How are they changing over time? What new trends are appearing among your particular target audience with relative to these factors? Racial and ethnic diversity. The U.S. is a diverse and ever-evolving marketplace that caters to consumers from a variety of social and cultural backgrounds. I digress from the main slide here to comment on the fact my wife loves France, goes to France often, speaks French, got her master's in French, is doing a 4-week class right now on French resistance in World War II, and was just talking recently about cultural differences between France and the U.S. And she was talking about the issue of immigration. Here in the States, we accept diversity. We celebrate Cinco de Mayo Day. We celebrate the Lunar New Year. We drink green beer for, what's that day? St. Patrick's Day. We accept a diverse group of people here. Diversity's okay. You should still be American, but you're diverse. She was making the point in France, when you immigrate, they'll accept you, but you need to become French. You need to accept French language, French values, French customs. They're not really big on St. Patrick's Day like we are, right? So there are cultural differences out here. This is one of our differences. As the U.S. becomes more diverse through its people, tastes, customs, and beliefs, companies strive to target demographics using marketing styles that are sensitive to individual attitudes, individual practices that are diverse. It's not just all the same. The importance of diversity in marketing has grown in response to increasing diversity of the U.S. population. According to the U.S. Census, more than 50% of the American population will be composed of minorities by the year 2042. Regardless of how you feel good or bad about that personally, if you're in business, if you're in marketing, you better recognize that there is this diverse population out there, yeah? So what are some of these diverse entities? So this is out of the 2020 census, last time they ran it. So Hispanic or Latino as a social group, as an ethnic group, 62.1 million in 2020, 18%, almost 19% of the total U.S. population. Hispanic or Latino are the largest minority group in the U.S. Add, they have over $2 trillion of disposable income. Is that a market opportunity for you? But at only 6% of overall ad industry investment, Hispanic consumers make up a disproportionately small proportion of the overall ad spending. So you represent 18, 19% of the population. We're only targeting you with about 6% of our ad dollars. Hispanic identity is much more diverse than the media portrays. For example, a quarter of U.S. Hispanics, according to the last census, also identify as Afro-Latino, which might not be what leaps to your mind when you think about Hispanic. Over 70% of this group prefer speaking Spanish at home, yet many brands rely on the fact that many of their Spanish-speaking consumers are bilingual, and rather than offering services in Spanish, those marketers rely on English only. Of course, this keeps their marketing costs down, but it may not be best for that target market you are trying to appeal to. Hispanic Americans are especially aware of social issues. They feel strongly they should be able to trust the brands they purchase from. They feel they can influence change more strongly with their wallets than with their votes compared to other demographics. 54% felt that they can better influence social issues through the brands they buy than by who they vote for. So put your dollars behind what you feel is right. Buy from those brands that you feel are representing you and your needs and your values and appealing to you. Let other people worry about the votes. So brands that align themselves with the values and issues that affect Hispanic communities are likely to find success. Big takeaway, brands have an opportunity with Hispanic consumers, and a big one. A more detailed understanding of this critical demographic would be key to better serving them and reaping the benefits of satisfying their needs, wants, and desires. So what I've done with these, I'm not focusing on the little map or the growth curve here, but you can see where Hispanic populations are especially strong in the little map. African Americans. In 2020, the black or African American population, 41.1 million, accounted for about 12% of all people living in the U.S., or in combination with another race, which they started measuring in the census, the population totaled 46.9 million people, 14.2% of the total population in 2020. Blacks or African Americans, depending on your preference for the categorization, are the second largest minority in the population of the U.S. They have $1.6 trillion in buying power. Of course, African Americans are not a homogeneous group. Not everybody's the same. They are diverse from their skin tones to the language preference that they use, cultural rules and mores to folkways. That is, there are subcultures within the African-American community. So if you're appealing to blacks and you're not of the black subculture, blacks are not all the same. They have different subcultures within them. You have to be aware of that. Black consumers are much more likely to seek out and place emphasis on brands that are trustworthy, have a clear social mission, appeal to their cultural values, and generally have credibility among their black community. Black consumers are more heavily weighted in the trendsetter segment. Fashion students, are we vaguely aware of blacks as being more trendsetters in the fashion industry than their population would call for? Which includes around 30% of black consumers. These are the folks who discover new products and services and proactively share them with their peers. If you can win over these black consumers as customers, they're going to help you expand the recognition of your new brand through their network and beyond. Despite a fair number of folks with a fair number of dollars, not all marketers realize what the needs, wants, and desires of this group are. So they're missing opportunities. Yes, African Americans drink bourbon. You'd never know it from the marketing groups, from the marketing that's out there. Groups like the Black Bourbon Society have formed to share an appreciation of the whiskey, and distillers are finally starting to pay attention. The growth in bourbon is coming from multicultural. For our brands to be sustainable in the future, we have to absolutely start with a multicultural lens. For many black bourbon drinkers, the change isn't coming fast enough. They say that most brands, when they do bother to reach out to their community, still pigeonhole African-American consumers with outdated playbooks aimed at, quote, urban demographics. As you might know, urban demographics is industry speak for lower income, young black consumers who supposedly gravitate towards sweeter spirits like cognac and flavored whiskeys. Don't promote to me with honey flavors or some hip-hop star, said Jamar Mack, an African-American bourbon fan of Louisville. My race is not my palate. What are the subtleties of appealing to a particular target audience other than the most gross categorization? Black Lives Matter movement, you may have heard of that, was one of the defining events of 2020. The protests involved millions of people across the U.S. and outside of it, and it affected global business and emphasized the need for corporate social responsibility, CSR, and socially responsible marketing. And it has then impacted brands. Aunt Jemima, as you may know, changed its name to the Pearl Milling Company, retiring its racist characterization of a black woman stemming from slavery. Band-Aid launched a line of Our Tone bandages to embrace the beauty of diverse skin tones in three shades of brown, available at retailers nationwide. Barbie has created its most inclusive doll line ever with 35-plus skin tones and more than 94 hairstyles and 9 body types. We are adjusting to ethnic sensitivity. Hallmark cards created Uplifted Empowered, which is a card collection written for and by black people, offering words that express solidarity and resilience. It's the first time Hallmark cards has addressed the issue of race. Netflix is allocating 2% of cash holdings, initially up to $100 million, to support the black community. It added a Black Lives Matter genre to its service, showcasing the celebrity of the work of black creators. Sephora signed the 15% pledge, dedicating 15% of its shelf space to black-owned companies. It commissioned the first ever large-scale study on racial bias in retail, and is training staff, monitoring incidents of racial bias, and updating loss prevention standards, and of course, more. This change in this particular segment of the population is big in influencing social values. If it's influencing your consumer's social values, you ought to be paying attention. One of the most important commitments brand can make is ensuring their products and services are authentically serving the black community. Brands must understand that diversity is not a trend, not a fleeting moment. They can no longer afford to ignore the growing economic clout of black consumers. Asian Americans, approximately 20 million people, or 6% of all respondents in the U.S. in the 2020 census. Asian Americans have about $1.3 trillion in spending power. Asian Americans, as individuals with ethnic groups stemming from countries including Cambodia, China, India, Japan, Korea, Malaysia, Pakistan, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam, you can immediately see they aren't all the same. They aren't all going to have the same needs, wants, desires, or cultural values, but they're categorized as Asian Americans. They are, given their numbers, overrepresented in high-earning science, technology, engineering, and mathematical-related fields. So they're 23% of those fields, while they're only about 12% of the total population. I see an inconsistency in my comment there. But anyhow, they are overrepresented in those fields. You might want to be aware of that. Family dynamics, greatly influenced by buying decisions among Asian Americans. Asian American households are 70% larger than average U.S. households. They're more likely to be multi-generational. What might that mean if you're going to appeal to them? Asian American community includes speakers of thousands of diverse dialects in over 50 languages. 81% say they speak English fluently. Asian Americans set the pace for consumer tech consumption and are the most digitally connected consumer group. 97% own a smartphone, 99% have internet access in their home, 89% own a computer. If that's your field, area, you might want to know more about Asian Americans. American Indians and Alaska Natives. So I did get busted for not being woke enough. Somebody told me American Indians is no longer the word. Right? Native Americans, First Peoples is the way to go. Sorry, guys, this is the census words, the census data. I'm reporting to you what census said in 2020. So I'm more woke than they are. There are 5.7 million who are American Indian and Alaska Native alone or in combination with one or more other ethnicities, making up 1.7% of the U.S. population. The Native American buying power is about $145 billion. The 10 states with the largest Native American markets are California, Oklahoma, Texas, Arizona, New York, New Mexico, Washington State, Florida, North Carolina, and Alaska. So they are out there, and there's a list of the tribes. Anybody have any Indian heritage that you know of in your background? Sometimes we get some folks that have that heritage. Now, you would say they're not a huge market, and they're not, but some companies, some brands are paying attention to them. For example, Nike developed a special shoe to help that particular audience. The Nike Swoosh Flies Again, this is the second attempt they had. The N7 program is giving Native golfers a lift. Anybody know in Native American population what the significance is of 7, N7? Maybe you know for any reason, not that you would, but sometimes somebody might. So the saying, supposedly, taking it from a guy who does not have any American Indian heritage, any Native American heritage, my understanding is that their attitude is that we need to pay attention to the three generations behind us, our current generation, and three generations ahead of us as a cultural thing. So there are seven generations we have to pay attention to. So supposedly Nike is aware of that with the naming of this. The Winged Nike is once again swooshing over Indian country in the form of new Nike N7 shoes. The latest version of the shoe designed specifically for Native Americans as a way of promoting physical fitness. The original Air Native N7 was designed back in 2007. After studying their body characteristics, their feet, it turns out that, in general, the shoes didn't fit them well. So these shoes had a larger fit for indigenous feet, as well as a culturally specific look. This is the first time that Nike has designed a shoe for a specific race or ethnicity. This one's wider at the toe, has a thicker sock liner for comfort, and fewer seams to cut down on irritation. The Nike N7 golf shoe is aimed at those natives who tee it up and aim for the green. There is also another population out there to think about, the white population. 235 million people reported white alone or in combination with another group. Largest population group in the U.S. currently about 71%. White only represents about 60%. So these folks have about 13.2 trillion buying power. They might be an audience for you. No, that's all I say about them. I guess I assume you know about the white population. So I guess I don't have a lot about that. They also have subcultures though within them. Other social fortunes like cultural tents, sustainability in marketing. We've heard now that different cultural, different cohort groups, age groups, want us to be sustainable, want us not to be killing the environment. So that's become a trend. Healthy living, eating better foods, eating healthier diets, exercising more. The hashtag Me Too movement, which I assume you've heard of. LGBTQ, etc. rights are a cultural trend. There's trends towards, on the one hand, do-it-yourself and makers. I guess on the other hand, people that are spending more money having others do it for them. Adventurers, people want to go out and live that experience, which we just talked about. Cocooning, some people are staying home more with creature comforts, home networks, home theaters, texting from home instead of going out and visiting people. Patriotism, taken in different ways, but that's a cultural trend that's out there. Anti-racism. So all of these social forces are things that may impact your consumers and hence your marketing. Now, it's important to note that from a certain segment's view, these attitudes, these trends are all liberal. And there is another side to the world, right? A more conservative side. So not all consumers support these liberal social trends. For example, State Farm Insurance provided support for a program program providing LGBTQ-themed children's books to teachers and libraries. But conservative groups and some media outlets derided the insurance company as a, quote, creepy neighbor and accused it of, quote, targeting children with books about gender identity. Hours after a report about the partnership prompted an online uproar from conservatives, State Farm announced that it was dropping its support of the Gender Cool Project, aimed at helping raise awareness around what it means to be transgender, inclusive, and non-binary. So your particular target audience may not be liberal. They may be conservative. You can't do anything good or stay in business if your target audience leaves you. So it's important to recognize there's two sides, at least two sides, but it's probably a multi-sided die, but at least two sides to it, more liberal and more conservative. What's your target audience? How do they play into your ads? Nike faced a fierce backlash for its 2018 ad featuring Colin Kaepernick, the former NFL quarterback who knelt during the national anthem to protest racism and police brutality. So how many guys like Chick-fil-A? Yeah, you like their chicken. How many guys object to their politics? Not too many people. So Chick-fil-A does not support, specifically does not support, LGBTQ rights, nor marriage equality. But it does rank as America's top brand for food quality, restaurant atmosphere, speed of service, staff friendliness, and overall value. They have, and they're not open on Sunday. Why are they not open on Sunday? Religious reasons, right? Our people deserve a day off. It should be God's day. They should go to church, whatever they want to do. We're not open on Sunday. Could they do more business if they were open on Sunday? Probably. They're standing by their conservative values. They're entitled to do that, right? The point, marketers do need to pay attention to their consumers' needs, wants, desires, and values. Conservative, liberal, you have to know what's going on in your target audience. Other cultural trends. Fashion students, are you making dresses for men? Men, are you interested in wearing dresses? Okay, you have a very small segment here of one who might be really interested in your new dress products. So the question is, how's this going to play out in the future? Is this going to be a thing or not? A while ago, and I think I took it off this slide, I had a slide about next cultural trends, unless it comes later, and it was men's nail polish. And I said, nah, that's not going to happen. Several students wrote me and said, what do you mean it's not going to happen? I'm a guy. I wear nail polish. Cultural values change. What's going to catch? What isn't going to catch? I had to change that slide. Maybe it's later in the course. But it's interesting about what trends catch on, what trends are slow, how it affects your business. Yes, ma'am?
I saw this like blackhead strip thing.
Oh, yeah?
And one specifically for men, specifically for women. They're the same thing.
No. One's for men, one's for women.
But...
Yeah, but one's for men and one's for women. Yeah. A different what? Yeah, a different bottle. You took the men. Was it cheaper? Was the men's one cheaper?
I forgot.
Often the case is they're virtually identical, but the guy's is cheaper, right? So, yeah, as long as some women want to buy a product for women, some women want to look at the price and say, that's ridiculous, so I'm going to buy the cheaper one. And some women want to make a statement, by God, I'm buying the man's one. Say again? Well, that was actually, and again, maybe it comes up later, because that was the question on the slide.
Oh.
What did make the nail polish gender-specific was the question. And yet this brand, Alpha Nail, had come out with nail polish for men.
That's
and that was the question. From a certain cohort's view of the world. Right?
It's all relative.
It's relative to your values, different groups. Economic forces are out there driving our consumers about willy-nilly and influencing them and us as well. The factors relating to income, expenditures, resources that affect the cost of running a business and a household, B2B and B2C side of things. Macroeconomic conditions, what's going on with inflation? You tell me. What's going on with unemployment, economic growth, or recession? And is there going to be one or not? Let me know the answer, please, because that's going to affect my business plan. What do I do? What am I planning for right now? Consumer income. What's going on with their gross income, the amount that they earn every year? How's that matching up against inflation? It doesn't matter if I'm getting a 5% increase if inflation's going up 7%. I'm still losing. What's going on with their disposable income after taxes? So what's going on with the political factor of taxes in the day that you're thinking about this stuff? What do they have after all the necessities are purchased? What is their discretionary income? How does that influence your consumer audience and your plans? We can combine demographics and economic factors, because none of these things are that simple when we think about our consumer audience. And here's one group that does that, making use of this sort of data. The ESRI community data identifies the top three neighborhood lifestyles to better serve your customers. ESRI's community tapestry segmentation system classifies each U.S. zip code based on the socioeconomic and demographic characteristics. They create 65 distinct market segments, 14 life modes, 6 urbanization groups. The notion here is that people of a certain cultural, subcultural, ethnic, income level tend to live together. Birds of a feather flock together. They live together. Not sure there's some disparity, but in your mind's eye, you might picture there being a difference between Pepper Pike, Beechwood, Hudson, Akron, Kent, Ravenna, in terms of the most of that population in these things. And that's this notion that you can think about these things geographically and think about who tends to live there. So we're bringing together some of these different values. So this is from that company, and let's see if we can find this real quick or not. So this would be geographic areas. They would then break this down and talk to you about the major lifestyles in each one of these appropriate geographic areas. We'll come back to this more when we talk about segmentation, but it's an interesting combination of the factors we've been talking about. This is an economic factor coming into play in the audio industry a while ago to understand the importance of economic forces in the audio industry then, but continuing.
Today was report card day for the auto industry, and it was a good one. Sales surged in December, capping a fifth straight year of growth for car makers. Analysts expect final sales for the year to exceed 17 million, a figure that hasn't been reached in more than a decade. Cheap gas helped boost sales of trucks and SUVs and luxury vehicles. Today, the price of oil briefly tumbled below $50 a barrel.
Before the bottom fell out of the economy, the car companies, especially ones from Detroit, were addicted to the sales of big trucks and SUVs. When gas prices skyrocketed, the companies nearly lost it all. Well, now we have crazy low gas prices, and consumers are gobbling up SUVs. Jeep, for example, was one of the biggest winners as consumers picked crossover SUVs. Its sales were up more than 40% for the year. At the same time, hybrid sales and alternative vehicle sales took a hit in 2014. Even though some of the hunger for bigger cars has picked up, maybe Detroit executives have learned a lesson from their near-death experience, and they haven't forgotten yet.
What you cleared out of the system in the last 4 or 5 years was 40 or 50 years of accumulated, perhaps bad behavior.
Painter says even though bigger vehicles are more profitable, today's cars, no matter the size, are far more fuel efficient. Stephanie Brindley with IHS Automotive says this 17 million is much healthier than the last time the industry hit 17 million cars a year. She says the industry has learned a very basic economic lesson.
The automakers in general have shifted to adjusting production for demand overall. So what will happen now is that if an auto manufacturer is seeing a vehicle not performing to expectations, they can adjust the number of vehicles that they produce.
So if gas skyrockets, then she says car makers can in theory shift from making big SUVs to making small cars. Meanwhile, Michelle Krebs with AutoTrader.com says consumers only save a few hundred dollars because gas is cheaper. That's not enough to send them into the dealership.
People keep focusing a lot on just gas prices, but that's not the full picture. There's a big economic picture at play here as well.
Krebs says the health of the auto industry comes not as much from cheap gas as from an improving unemployment rate, improving consumer confidence, low interest rates, and
credit was widely available, and we saw a big increase in leasing. So that made vehicles available to more people on a wider spectrum of credit worthiness.
Krebs says the business model for car makers has changed in the last decade. Car makers can turn a profit selling far fewer cars. Krebs says she expects consumers and car companies to enjoy the cheap gas while it lasts.
So the point is not that this is a 2016 example, which I understand isn't current, but rather an understanding of how these crest factors are important to a big industry like auto executives. And you would say they don't recognize, and they hadn't, that they can't just sell whatever they're making, that consumer demand shifts and they have to be agile enough to make that change. And here they're saying, well, they've learned that lesson. You have to be able to change to satisfy the changing needs, wants, and values. That was true in 2016. It's true today as well. The industry has learned a very basic economic lesson: adjust production for overall demand. My comment, duh, but really, it was a problem. So, likewise, understanding which factors influence your consumers. Naively, well, which cars people buy depends on gas prices. Yeah, but it also depends on unemployment rate, consumer confidence, interest rates, credit. It's more complicated, and you have to understand that.
The economic slowdowns, we've been through several of them. This particular one, as it hits raw materials and fuel costs and petroleum-based products, is hitting everywhere, and it's hitting a little faster. The larger clients that we work with are getting ahead of the curve. Some are feeling the pinch right away. Others are anticipating feeling the pinch. So what can we learn as a small business from this? A, it's affecting our clients, it affects us. It may affect us a little more dramatically down the road, but what we're trying to do is find ways to help them. And this may mean that the current services we're providing them now might need to be put on hold, and we may need to address other things that we can help them in the immediate need. For example, if they're really pushing for sales and we're working on public relations, and public relations is generating leads, but sales doesn't have literature to fulfill, maybe we need to focus our attitudes, and that's happened in some clients where we've really need to hone down what do they need right now in this particular setting. So adjusting to our clients' needs is important, and what we're learning is that our job is going to be to have some more foresight on the next slowdown or the next major turn, whatever that event may be, and try to anticipate what our clients are going to go through. That's what will add value down the road for our clients.
So whether we're marketing B2C like cars or B2B like marketing services to clients, economic forces impact our consumers, business or ultimate consumers. And we as a business have to track it, be aware of it, and think about how it's going to influence us. And it may have to change what we're offering, whether it's cars or marketing services. So we have to be aware of these things. Technology forces. Technology has impacted consumer choices. It's impacted their view of value. In general, as you know, technology gets cheaper and cheaper to include into items, cheaper and cheaper on the consumer side. These reduced costs means that customers begin to focus on the other attributes of what the product you're buying. Because technology is getting cheaper and cheaper, we're seeing it included in more and more new products and faster introduction of new products. We're seeing technology enable things like changes to production. So we're able to produce packaging or products that increase the possibility of recycling. Again, I'm on fashion today. How many fashion students have heard about this new, entirely compostable clothing line? No? Yeah? You have. So there's a new product line that's being made from, I don't know how you can both wash it and have it be compostable, but once you're done with the product, you can put it out in your garden, and it will compost into sustainable products. I assume that's technology at work. Sustainability, of course, is something that's important. Technology has influenced our market space. The information and communications-based electronic exchange of information where physical boundaries no longer interfere with buy-sell decisions. Think, of course, e-commerce. The many specific industry market spaces and integration of marketplaces through sophisticated computer and telecommunication technologies as it changes and influences us. Think, what am I trying to say here, IT folks? The next Web3, Metaverse, what's that going to mean for our businesses, etc. In a market space, information and or physical goods are exchanged. Transactions take place through computers and networks, and more through AR. So electronic commerce, the intranet, where we talk about electronic digital sharing information within our company, extranet, extending our organization's intranet to outside users, our partners, our vendors, our suppliers. No one else can see it, but our partners can. And I see I have less than a minute left, so we'll pick up electronic business technology and the impact of COVID-19 next time. Don't forget to do mini test 2. Have a good day.